Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Chatting with Sherry. Today we're going to speak with author, and please forgive me if I mess up your name, Guido Mina Di Sperino, and he wrote
Yeah, you go. Okay.
Suspiro. And he wrote the book, The Metaphysics of Ping Pong. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Hi. Nice to be
Hi.
Here.
Hi. Why don't you tell my audience a little bit about yourself and your background?
Yes. I'm a writer originally from Italy. I've been living in this country for over 30 years. I went to the University of Southern California, studied cinema production, and ever since then I've been writing books, both novels and nonfiction. This particular book, The Metaphysics of Ping Pong, is actually an example of narrative nonfiction, which is a very strange thing to say, but that's how it's called technically. And I'm published in 13 languages, in many titles and many countries all over the world, and this is my latest.
And were you always a writer as a child? Is that, or did you come through that through schooling? Or when did you start writing? Because I have a lot of new writers that are listening.
No, I was very much into music and cinema when I was in my teens growing up, and I played the guitar at an absurdly good level, the classical guitar. But that, again, was something that used to happen in the 70s. The amateurs were ridiculously good, so I was just one of them. Playing the guitar, really studying it 8 hours a day or something like that. And then the piano. And then I got into cinema, too, which at the time used to be very intelligent. No longer, but now it's TV. It's the opposite of what it used to be. And writing came along with it, because as I was studying both the cinema and music, I was reading a lot of material on both, and it just developed alongside, and then I decided to go that way. I also was a journalist from Los Angeles, and I was part of the Hollywood Foreign Press in the 80s, so I did a lot of that type of work, and corresponding from Los Angeles in music and cinema. And then I began to write books, and they were published.
Oh, you were a member of the Foreign Press. Did you vote for the Golden Globes?
No, not the Golden Globes. I used to go to cover the, what were they called? The Music Awards, or what they call it? I don't remember. The Grammys for music. Yes, the Grammys, and you know, the Academy Awards, that kind of stuff. I used to do that. And, you know,
That's cool.
Of interviews, a lot of editorials, a lot of, I mean, when music, again, the music industry back in the 80s was still very vibrant and alive. You know, now it's essentially dead. So there was a lot of activity and a lot of stuff going on. It was fun. It was exciting to be in Los Angeles and be doing that while at the same time going to university.
And when did you begin to write? Was it at the university?
No, yes. Well, I've been writing all along, really. The first, you know, I was first published at 17 with music reviews for a jazz magazine, which happens to be the oldest jazz magazine in Europe. And then I took it from there. I became a professional music critic. And I went on, and then I began to write my own stuff. So I've been published forever, really, since my teenagehood, I guess, in various languages.
And what do you like to read?
Well, that's a good question. I'm omnivorous. I mean, I will read what's written on the milk carton. I mean, I'll read junk mail. I'll read anything. I just cannot stop reading. So I do have preferences. I mean, I do like to read things that are not exactly canonical. I do like the broad umbrella of rejected knowledge, but I don't like it to be written by charlatans. I like it to be written by scholars who, however, go out and explore things that are not taught to us by the establishment, be it school or university or whatever. For example, I like to read problems with Darwinism, you know, because now Darwinism is accepted as something that is simply correct and right, and there are many, many problems with it, voiced by scientists, not by, you know, religious people. And that's just one of many. And I enjoy reading those sort of things because it's good to have different canons, not just one, because then our thinking becomes very obtuse, I would say.
And do you read any fiction, or is it all nonfiction?
No, no, I also read fiction. It varies, though. I mean, I read Russian authors, American authors, English, French, German, from the past to contemporary, all the way down to Flashman by MacDonald Fraser and all his novels. And yes, I do read fiction too.
And do you have a favorite genre?
Well, yes, I do like singular voices. I do like something that is unlike what's out there. For example, my publisher in Italy now is going to be bringing out The Metaphysics of Ping Pong in Italian, in translation, told me over dinner that he likes books that cannot be pigeonholed. He likes books that don't belong to any category in particular. Now, that's the exception. Most publishers want books that belong very firmly in one or two categories, so they're easy to sell. They're easy for book owners to shelf, and they're easy for Amazon to tag. And what I like is the opposite. I like books that are all over the place, that you don't really know how to define, like The Metaphysics of Ping Pong, for example, which is, I mean, how many times do you find philosophy and ping pong mixed together? You know? So I like stuff that is unusual, really very unusual, because otherwise it's really like a cliche festival. I mean, you read so many things that have been said already because so much has been written. And I think publishers are beginning here and there to embrace new things. Although the history of the metaphysics of ping pong is complex, because this is what happened. Usually in the industry, since you said that writers are listening in, I may explain something about the industry. Usually when it's a nonfiction book, you send in through your agent a proposal, a very well-written proposal, and then if a publisher is interested and if an agreement is reached, then you go ahead and write a book along the lines, you know, of that proposal. I did that. That went nowhere, so I wrote a sample chapter, and they didn't get it. I wrote a second sample chapter, they didn't get it. So I wrote the whole book, they still didn't get it. So I changed agent, I went to England, and there they then they got it on the first submission, which goes to show. And then it was published there, and then it was published here, and it's going to be published internationally, etc. But it was a very difficult beginning, precisely for the problem that it's an unusual book, and publishers are still afraid of publishing something that's not exactly, say, a novel or you know, a specific genre. But I think that on the other hand, A, there is space for everything, and B, many, many readers are just very bored with the same formula writing and the same thing all the time, and they like something different, something that they haven't read before.
And what do you think about the way the publishing world has been expanding? There's, like, so many different ways to get published. There's so many different vehicles of getting your word out there, not just as a book, but all different forms of publishing. What do you think of the explosion of publishing?
I have mixed feelings about it, because I'll give you an example. I have a friend who is in his 80s, and he wrote a book about the Kennedys, or perhaps against the Kennedys, I should say, thinking that he had great truths to reveal and that his life would be in danger or something, and he self-published. And the book didn't move at all, because who knows that the book is self-published? There are tens of thousands of self-published books every year, every month maybe. So now everybody he meets, he tries to sell the book to, every new person he meets. And it's really boring to be in his company when that happens, because you know that he's going to go into that until he makes the sale. And is that what we want? I mean, is self-publishing I mean, I understand that traditionally some famous authors did self-publish originally because, you know, and because they were unable to get their book published. But most of the
time,
it goes
all the way back to Jane Austen. She did
absolutely,
Jane.
Absolutely, yes. Lots, so I understand that that's the argument that a lot of people who are into self-publishing will appeal to. The reality is that most of the stuff that is self-published goes nowhere. Now, if it's vanity publishing, fine. I mean, it's a much cheaper way to go about it than once, which was very expensive because it still had to go through a printing press, et cetera, et cetera. But that's one thing. And blogs, et cetera, some of them are very important, but most of them, frankly, who are these people writing for? I mean, so the proliferation of writing of all sorts and all different kind of publishing, in the end, I still prefer to be published traditionally because it's an accomplishment. It's difficult to be published traditionally. It's difficult to get an agent. It's difficult to get, a large publisher to be interested in your stuff. And when they do, it's because they think that there's a good chance that your book will be read around, and so it will be important for them to get. In other words, I think that there's got to be a good compromise between quality and the commercial potential of a book. So I suppose I'm rather traditional still in my view. But, you know, I would resort to self-publishing, I suppose, if nobody published me, but luckily that's not the case.
Well, there is a lot of people who do independent publishing who do very well. And as a blogger, I know that I have thousands of people who read my blog. Well, that's not exactly accurate, but I understand where you're coming from. I'm just saying that there's more things in, well, I was about to quote from Hamlet.
they will do. No, I mean, listen, there are some blogs, I mean, some blogs are doing well, and I am very impressed, and I like that. I mean, I myself write on two blogs, by the way. I write on Reality Sandwich, which is out of New York, and I write on a website of alternative views, which is called Disinformation. I write a lot for them. So it's not that I don't, but they do have an established following. I don't understand people who say, oh, I'm going to go move to Sarajevo and write my blog. Nobody reads that. That's the reality. I mean, you have a radio show, you've been around, you're established, it's different. But for people who think that they're going to go somewhere and take out their notepad and write something, and you know, people are gonna why should they read that instead of something, you know? I mean, it's I'm not so, I mean, there are a number of blogs out there that have a following, so they're legitimate, but many, I mean, I'm talking about, again, we're making the exception, the self-published title, which becomes a bestseller, or never mind a bestseller, which sells well enough, 2,000 copies, whatever, great. But the vast majority of self-published stuff doesn't go anywhere, and that is the reality. And I think it would be disingenuous to tell people the opposite, because I know firsthand a lot of people that, you know, they just didn't go anywhere, because Amazon is there for everyone. But unless you're directed to a certain book, and unless there are reviews and people speaking about it, it's difficult to get your book read.
Well, I interview a lot of authors, and I don't think I'm being disingenuous at all. To say that there are some very successful self-publishing authers, award-winning.
I'm not saying there aren't. I'm saying that the vast majority of them are not. I mean, literally there are tens of thousands of people who self-publish, and you know, there are not tens of thousands of people who do well by self-publishing.
Okay, all right.
Some of them do well,
move...
but not all of them.
Okay, let's move on to your book. Why don't you explain what it's about? I mean, we gave a little bit of information, but why don't we talk a little bit about what it's about? Get your audience to understand. Please don't read from it because we only have 15 minutes, but just give them an idea and what you'd like to take from it.
Yes, quickly. I fell back in love with table tennis in my middle age, which I used to play it as a teenager, but I never found really very good opponents, and then I did a lot of other things, so I lost sight of it. Then I got back with it, and I happened to find this community center in which there were a lot of Chinese players, and it was a revelation and a shock, and I could have left it right there because I didn't even see the ball, or I could have taken it up and go through all the humiliations, etc., and I did. And what struck me from the very beginning, because of my background and because of the things I have been writing and reading all my life, is that there were parallels between the game of table tennis and what I call the perennial philosophy, which is a perspective in the philosophy which views each of the world's religious traditions as sharing a single universal truth on which the foundation of all religious knowledge and doctrine have grown. So I found characteristics in table tennis, which were, for example, non-Euclidean because of the trajectory of the ball, which is never straight but always in parabolas, and a lot of spin imparted on the ball. And all of that reminded me of a world different from the mechanistic, reductionistic world in which we still live. And usually, what I mean by non-linear thinking, which is a typical Sufi and Zen and Tao expression, I explain on page 6 to give the reader an idea. And if you don't mind, I will read that passage quickly. Is that okay with you?
Yeah, but it's a very short, because we only
yes,
have
yes.
13
it's,
minutes. Okay.
Yes, yes, yes. I will read it quickly. Now, this is from a TV commercial from New Zealand. And it goes as follows. Students are taking an exam. A rather pompous professor is watching them while the clock is ticking. Time, thank you, he eventually says. Put down your pens and bring your papers to the front of the room. All students do so but one. He's wasting time scratching an instant lottery ticket, but he could be finishing the exam. This one student reaches a desk to turn in the exam past the allotted time. The professor says, sorry, too late. The student is dumbfounded. I gave you plenty of warnings about time, resumes the professor. You failed. Sorry. Excuse me, says the student in a matter-of-fact tone, but do you know who I am? The professor contemptuously. I have absolutely no idea. Good, says the student, and places his paper in the middle of the stack. That is nonlinear. That is what we do not expect. In other words, anonymity helps the student, not the other way around, and it's the professor who's being tested. The student puts his paper in the middle of the stack. The professor doesn't know whose paper it was. Therefore, the professor will be grading the paper. End of story. It's that simple, but it's brilliant. And I like the idea of finding an example of nonlinear thinking in the world of commercials, because it's something that it is with us in our life. And I found it also in table tennis. And I wrote the whole book, The Metaphysical Ping Pong, about that, nonlinear thinking. In other words, thinking of a sort that we're not used to, because we think in terms of cause and effect. And I think that all the Chinese players I met with, as well as Taoism, are all about accidentality rather than causality.
Very interesting. And how did you bring Descartes and Jung and all the different philosophers into table tennis and that? I don't think most of the audience would understand that, really.
All right, let's see. Carl Gustav Jung was a Swiss psychoanalyst. He's basically the founder of modern psychoanalysis. And we owe to him the popularization of the I Ching in the West. The I Ching are this very ancient, 5,000-year-old Chinese book, first used to be recorded orally, and then it was written down about 3,000 years ago. As I was saying, the I Ching, what Jung says about the I Ching is that what struck him about it is that it seemed to be concerned only with accidentality. In other words, things that occur by accident, we would say. Meaningful coincidences, for example. They could not care less about cause and effect, which is the building foundation of Western philosophy since Aristotle onwards. Because it's so pedantic, they know there is cause and effect, but they're not going to build a philosophical system on that. Because at the core, the universe doesn't work like that. It's just too simple. It's an oversimplification. And that's one thing. And the other thing I bring in Jung when I speak about the shadow, which is a concept that he developed too, the shadow is something that lives within all of us, and it's our darker brother, he calls it, or sister, which sometimes does the thinking for us and makes us do things that we would never rationally contemplate doing. And it happened to me because specifically I went to this one club, table tennis club in D.C., that I knew I shouldn't go to, but the other one was closed and I still wanted to go and play. And it's people essentially by ex-convicts, and it's kind of problematic usually. There are problems there. And this young man challenged me, and I said, fine. And then I went ahead and I defeated him, and he just couldn't stand being defeated by me because I was twice his age and one head shorter than he was. And he thought, but table tennis really is about technique more than physical strength. And so he chased me out, and he wanted me to go back in, and it was late at night, and there were five or six of his pals. They were ready, in other words, to take me apart or something. And I was saved by these other Chinese players who essentially whisked me away in their car. And then when I got home, I asked myself, what on earth made me accept the challenge, or what on earth made me insist on winning? I could have just been beaten, and that was the end of the story. And I realized that back when I was in Italy still, there was a lot of terrorism going on, the Red Brigades, etc., and there was a lot of bullying all around. And I essentially was cornered for no reason by four people wearing baklavas and wielding iron bars, and they essentially wanted to kill me or something for no reason. Oh, I think I was wearing a tie or something. That was the problem for them in their youth. So, and I had gone through a lot of bullying, and now this time I felt the same. Not I, my shadow felt exactly the same atmosphere and recognized it and was finally going to get his vindication, defeating this guy. A great peril for me. So sometimes we have our darker brother or sister doing the thinking for us, and we have to understand when that is happening and try to counteract that rationally, because sometimes what our shadow will make us do is very dangerous for us. So, and that was Jung's, yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense. We don't have a lot of time, and I want you to be able to let people know, do you have any events that are coming up, either online or in person, that people can come see you?
Well, yes, there's a lot of radio going on, but I wouldn't be able to tell you exactly all the different programs happening, etc., and there are reviews coming on all the time. But they can update themselves on my website, which is guido.mina.d.sospiro.at. GuidoMiaSospiro.com. It's or, you know, just find it on the internet, see what's going on, just put in my name.
Okay. Yeah. And my last question, we can have a little time. I have two questions. One is, what is your great passion in life?
Well, I would say absolutely reading and writing. Absolutely. Because they're all encompassing. So I can learn about everything, and that's what I still love. I mean, I have a congenital curiosity, and I never stop being interested about everything. So that's it, reading and writing.
Okay.
And, I mean, I would say ping pong, but ping pong is kind of an outgrowth of my interest in reading and writing, in a sense. So music, cinema, you know, there's a lot. Traveling, there's a lot. But let's just stick to reading and writing.
And the last question is, you're very busy, and mm-hmm. you're a writer, so writers need private time. How do you balance your need to write with your family obligation or friend obligations with friends and things? Do you find balance in that?
Well, that is a very difficult question and a very good one, too. It's very difficult because, as you said correctly, writers need peace. I mean, it's usually we have a busy mind, and we don't need any external stimulation once the mind is cooking stuff. But there are all those obligations, and you have to make do. You have to find time for both. In the end, it's all worth it, I think, I hope. And there's no recipe. I mean, it's up to the individual. I don't think doing one thing only all the time is very sane as an approach, because mm-hmm. you become something of a Captain Ahab or something, a monomaniac, you know. But, you know, it's difficult. I just spent the whole summer in Europe because I had to, and I didn't like to. And I realized one thing that I had never realized that my co-author, Jocelyn Godwin, told me, that I never got a place in Europe, he said, because I realized that I would have to duplicate my library. And I cannot do that. I have too many books. But I realized over there that I was missing them physically. I mean, because I go back to them. I consult them all the time. They're not just there, you know, accumulating powder and dust. And so it's a problem. It's difficult to be away from your books. It's difficult to be away from your mind. But sometimes we have to. I think it would also be very difficult to be always with your mind and with your books. You
right.
become like Nietzsche or something.
Right. Because the thing is that, as you said, it's not healthy. You have to, and you can't write if you don't experience life, so you can't be
Oh, absolutely.
In your room.
I mean, there is that too, yes, of course. But there is also truly the fact that sometimes, you know, many writers would probably share this feeling with me that you are in a certain place that you don't really need to be at, and you're thinking, there are better books for me to read than just, you know, better ways of spending my time than being here, which is terrible, but it's true. Sometimes it's just, it seems like chore after chore. Or,
you know,
but other times it's very enjoyable and you're happy that you made the experience. So
it's hard. There's a balance. I actually, a girlfriend asked me about what do you do if you're bored at a party, and I find a quiet nook and I pull my book out and read.
Yeah, that's what my wife does. And now with the e-reader, you know, she's just, it's just heaven for people like that, because it's just, I cannot do that. I mean, I just find it rude because, but I understand exactly. I understand exactly. And sometimes
well,
I feel
I mean,
like
if
that
somebody
too.
Somebody comes and talks to me, that's different. But if I'm just like bored and there's no one really to talk to, but you're there and you have to be there, then I pull it out and I read.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I just never found the courage of doing that because, you know, it's... But I will think about it now. I'll look for a quiet corner. And it's a good idea. Just not doing it in front of them is probably, you know, the better thing. To say, okay, let me take out my book.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah, that's just because my mind is always going and I have to do something because I can't just stand there and stare at people.
I know, the mind is busy. That's something that, I hate to say this, normally qualified people who don't write. Okay, so non-writers don't understand that real writers have a busy mind. It just doesn't stop. It doesn't stop. Wherever you are, you may be driving or fishing or something, whatever, it doesn't stop. And
sure.
And it's you know, it's nice because you're alive. Maybe you're more alive than they are because you realize how... But at the same time, it comes in the way of socializing and doing... normal things, because often you're saying, that's more interesting what I thought I had the other day, and I want to look it up and follow it. But not everything is boring. I mean, as I said, I love traveling. I love, you know, there's a lot of stuff that I find nice. But it always has to be a little angular. I don't like regular stuff. I like things that are just unusual from anyone.
Yeah. I understand that. Mm-hmm. Sadly, we've come to the end of the show. Thank you very
thank
much
you.
For being on. I hope you enjoyed it.
Yes, I did, and thank you for having me.
Thank you. And thank you for chatting with Sherry.
Thank you.
Thank you.